So it's my great pleasure to welcome back to Many Rivers Books and TV Home Padma. She is the author, as many of you will know, who spoke, because she spoke here a couple of years ago, about this, her first book, Living the Season, Zen Practice for Transformative Times. Today she's going to be talking about the subject of her occupation for the last few years, which has been her PhD dissertation at Sophia University, and that is about the subject of the healing power of presence for Buddhist healers. So I won't say more about that topic because we'll hear more about that, but Jihong has her PhD now in hand, as it were. Not in her hands right now, of course, but nevertheless, she could have it in her hand if she wished so to do. She has combined an academic career with her vocation as a spiritual teacher. She served as director of spirituality and education at Wellesley College for 14 years, was meditation teacher at Harvard University, Esalen Institute, and Omega Institute. She's done intensive Zen training and teaching in Asia and North America for over 20 years, served as abbot of Cambridge Zen Center. Of course, she holds a doctorate in psychology, as I said, from Sophia University. She was a student of Song San, the same Zen teacher as our own Jim Wilson studied with for many years. So it's my great pleasure, and I invite you to join me in welcoming back Jihong Padma to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
Thank you. So I'm really delighted to be back. I feel that the community that's been created at Many Rivers is really something special. You know, there's a kind of intimacy here and a sort of depth of experience and diversity of experience, you know, and so it just makes it a place that I would cross the continent to speak at, right? You know, effectively I have. It was hard leaving Omega, but knowing that I was coming here, it was okay. So, I was getting a doctorate in psychology, but specialized in traditional Buddhist healers. Well, you know, it's kind of funny. Most people who are writing a doctorate in psychology don't write about that. So, for first, you know, why? Why do that? First of all, within my practice of Buddhism, you know, it's always been accompanied by the somatic piece. The way that I began Zen practice was through studying Aikido, actually, with Kanai Sensei, who was one of the students of Morihei Ueshiba. And then, because of the Aikido, I had to study Shiatsu, because if you're studying Aikido, you need Shiatsu, honestly. You need a little fixing up. And so I studied Zen Shiatsu, and those experiences were the first things as a college student that took me out of a purely cognitive life, right, and really into the body, and trusting that place of not knowing. Recognizing, you know, this gave me a big question, you know, so what is that? And so when I had a big Aikido test coming, I started going to the Cambridge Zen Center for Meditation Practice. The Zen really did improve my Aikido. It improved my focus and my groundedness, and the test went well. But after that test, I had this big question going on. Like, I couldn't sleep that night. Well, that wasn't really what it was about. It wasn't just to do well on the test. So what was it about? And so then the next morning, for the first time, I went to the Cambridge Zen Center for morning practice, and it started anew, and you know, a little bit more intensively. So, you know, since then, I've focused on Zen training and found that psychology offers a way of understanding it, you know, a way of understanding how this works, why it works. The greatest psychology teachers I've had have taught me that regardless of the modality, that is, whether you're using Gestalt, whether you're using cognitive behavioral, whether you're using a Jungian approach, you know, studies have shown that regardless of the modality, what the single most important factor in whether that therapy is really going to take is the therapist-client relationship. That relationship actually is what heals. You know, so then that also, you know, sort of made me curious. Well, that's what I experienced with my teachers, you know, with Sungsan Sanim and with Mahako Sananda, the Cambodian teacher who had come through, you know, who really embodied loving kindness. So I thought, you know, there's something in our tradition. It, obviously, that is healing. You know, before we had the religion, so to speak, of psychology, the people who did that work, who handled the concerns and the well-being of people before the therapist, were the priests, the rabbis, the monks. And if you look into these traditions, you know, the healing practices that, you know, that are intact, that are found in traditional Chinese medicine, Korean medicine, Vietnamese, you know, all these kind of families of medicines, there was often a really strong connection with Buddhism. It's not always sort of survived intact because of a lot of different cultural factors. You know, in the 20th century, you know, the forces of both colonization and then also the mission system, you know, the Christian movements in these countries, you know, were reasons that in, for instance, Thai medicine, you know, the connection to Buddhism isn't always as strong now, you know, or in Chinese medicine, you know, communism really separated Chinese medicine from some of its more spiritual origins, you know, towards the direction of making something more scientific, more materialistic, and I don't know, maybe more replicable, but definitely from the people I speak to, the ones who are practicing in a traditional way really feel that their teachers, you know, who have held the lineage in the original way, you know, have seen it as a spiritual practice. Another reason that I came to this particular topic was that I studied mindfulness-based stress reduction and trained as a MBSR teacher. And absolutely, you know, I found that that helped me. It certainly has opened many doors. It's a good route. And yet, right here, I am a little curious. Is it really that everything that is sort of therapeutically beneficial in the Buddhist tradition is exclusively Theravadin? Or everything that is therapeutic happens to be, I don't know, conducive to the Western medical point of view? It's by creating mindfulness-based stress reduction, Jon Kabat-Zinn obviously did the world a great service. But at the same time, I think we have to be curious about the choices that are made and what that reflects about our culture and what it is that we might actually gain, you know, from, again, looking back at the roots. In anthropology, Rob and I have had this conversation. Very often, the word ritual is used as a kind of derogative word. If anthropologist is using the word ritual, it's basically referring to something that's superstitious, you know, a culture that's a little bit, I don't, fascinating, but maybe not so modern. If an anthropologist is speaking about their own culture's religion, their own culture's spiritual practice, the word that's most likely to turn up is the word liturgy. But the word ritual, it gets a bad rap. However, you know, there is some movement within that sort of world of medical anthropology. You know, there's some folks who are sort of reclaiming the use of the word ritual and actually applying it to Western medical practices. And that is where things get, you know, for me, interesting. A woman, Cheryl Mattingly, has done a lot of research on this. She's written, one of her books is called Performance Narratives in the Clinical World. And it's turning that supposition that ritual is superstitious upside down. It's by saying performance narratives, you know, she's saying ritual, and she sort of goes into that in her text. That while we have this call really to look beyond that narrowly constructed clinical case to see to see the patient as a person, you know, one who is inhabiting a social world, you know, one who is in the midst of making a life of meaning, one who is within their own ecosystem. And the performed narratives that have healing potential are the ones that engender hope. They create significant experiences. Words are part of it, but it's actually the embodied actions that carry the meaning. So what she's saying effectively is it's not that the folks in indigenous cultures are using ritual and the ones in our Western culture are not using ritual. The fact is the people in indigenous cultures are aware that they're using ritual and they're using it effectively. You know, the folks in our culture who are using ritual are often doing so kind of verklempt because they don't actually know that they're making ritual. And that, you know, that can cause a problem. The idea that the patient, you know, is a sort of part, you know, to be fixed. You know, he's the ruptured appendix, you know, or the emphysema case, right? It's, that is by nature, you know, removing the patient, you know, from their sense of meaning, you know, from their place in the ecosystem. You know, it's a mistake that is kind of chronic within our society. You know, within our industrial society, you can see the same thing in the school systems. You know, they sort of turn out the students, you know, based on, you know, whether they're able to you know, take on certain tests and score at a certain number, and it's kind of mechanistic. It's only looking at the student as something really that's going through the system. But when we are able then to look beyond the person as a part, you know, we're able to see the people, you know, and to see them in their wholeness, this evolves not only the person, you know, it not only reconnects the person with their resources, but it is actually shifting our institutions. Peter Senge wrote a beautiful book about this. Peter Senge and Otto Schwarmer wrote a book on presence. And so their whole theory is that we need to return to eco-culture awareness of each other. You know, that quality of presence is what shifts outcomes not only between the patient and the doctor, but it also shifts outcomes in things like Guatemala's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, or conversations between labor and management, you know, or, you know, conversations within a tech company, you know, about a merger they're doing or a product that they're designing. You know, it has all kind of ramifications. And what makes that quality of presence work is, first of all, really learning to see. You know, like as we sit in meditation, you know, we begin to find that space in between the thoughts, right? Then out of that, we begin to be able to work from this place of wholeness. First finding the wholeness within ourselves, and then from that, being able to see other people in that light. When we're able to come from this place, that ecosystem awareness, then we're able to come up with solutions, you know, that are based on a deeper knowing than we can actually access consciously. You know, we could call it a tacit knowing, you know, a body-centered knowing. That's the kind of knowing that I feel, you know, my great Aikido teachers, Kanai Sensei, or my Zen teachers, you know, were able to transmit. You know, it's a place from before words. So when I was interviewing these healers, one of the inspirations also was of writing from Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche, who said, ritual is a form of language. You know, it's an embodied language. And so again, I'm hearing the same thing that Cheryl Mattingly said. It's ritual is embodied language. So although I'm focusing on the narratives of these healers, the way that I'm going to go into it is through their work. you know, through their rituals of practice. And what are they creating there? You know, so getting curious about that. Not breaking it down into, you know, what their needle technique is for the acupuncturist, or, you know, what exact order of a puja is, you know, for the ones who are doing pujas. But looking at what might be some of those common rituals, you know, across the denominations. There's another person who's done something like this, Kaz Chiono, who is a Joan Kaz Chiono is a Puerto Rican researcher who wrote a book on spiritual transformation and healing. You know, she wrote it when there was some sort of substantial nice grant that was out there for people who were doing research on transformation. And so what she looked at was, what are those key elements of healing across cultures? And what she identified were some of the same things that I identified, which was, you know, the quality of relationship, a radical empathy, then also a spiritual transformation. So some of the healers that I spoke to said, in order for the healing to really happen, in order for it to go deep, there needs to be some change of consciousness. You don't solve the situation at the same level that it was created. You know, something needs to shift. So that change of awareness is shifting not only the mind but also the body. You know, there are some healers who I spoke to who said, who sort of look at that consciousness and matter as a non-discontinuous continuity. You know, sort of different elements of the same system. You know, there are different hypotheses about that. You know, there's one called the biofield hypothesis. And the biofield hypothesis says, you know, that really there's a sort of like energetic system around the body that's maintaining homeostasis. And for that reason, all it takes is a little stimulus, for the kind of stimulus a needle can do, the kind of stimulus Reiki can do, something like that. And it takes just that bit of a nudge to go back into its natural alignment. And that's one theory about how the subtle energy stuff works. You know, some of the heart math people, you know, have gone and measured and said there's this magnetic field that surrounds the body. And because the heart is emitting such a strong field, anyone who comes within a few feet of us, their body is already attuning, you know, to our body. Their energy field is directly magnetically attuning to ours. You know, in a less, in a very basic way, right? In psychology, we can look at this as in terms of limbic resonance. Limbic resonance means that, like, all the time, our body language is attuning together. Because the system, the limbic system, which is how we know our own body, is the same system through which we know other people's emotions and respond to them. That process takes place through these things called mirror neurons in the brain. The mirror neurons are the things that tell us, you know, if our hand is above our head, it gives us that input. If also, you know, we see something happen, if we see a sort of child scrape their knee outside on the pavement, we instinctively feel, you know, a wince inside us as if it was our own body. It's not. But the mirror neurons are giving us that information. They're relaying it through the same system that tells us about our own body. So through that limbic resonance, any time that you're with a good healer, a good therapist, they're able to establish a rapport that goes beyond words. You know, your heart and mind attuned to each other. So there's what I would say, basically, those are a few different ways in which consciousness is bringing about that change, you know, through our connection, through our relationships. You know, for a good healer, that begins way before their treatment begins. You know, maybe in the way that they've greeted you. There's a story that one of the folks I interviewed tells. His name is Lama Jinpa. He's in Southern California, and he's a practitioner of Shud, sort of Tibetan ritual, and he also works as a homeopath, among other things. So he says the vision of the healer, the knowledge, and that vision is informed by their perception of the individual. A perception that, of course, the individual doesn't always have about themselves. They don't see their wholeness particularly. Much of my work is empowering another by being able to perceive what their true powerful nature is, or their true healthy nature is, underneath the veil. So one can see, even in spite of their relative rigidity, there are many different possibilities. And so as far as the healer's consciousness goes, the minute someone steps into the room, for me, the healing is taking place because I'm seeing them in the most accurate, most positive light. I don't mean positive thinking, but that I'm accurately perceiving their wholeness. This immediately has an inductive effect on them. It's inducing the possibility of them perceiving that and also starting to function from that place. You know, if someone encourages you, believes in you, when no one else did before, it gives you a whole new perspective. When the healer is doing that on a subconscious level, they're empowering, literally, initiating that person in such a way that it emboldens them to start living their real life, instead of a karmically restricted life. You know, that's a huge factor. That can be reinforced herbally, and it can be reinforced by knowledge and information and different things. You know, so just in that initial connection, already the way that the healer relates to the client, something is going on. Then, for many of these practitioners, many of them were Tibetan doctors or they're acupuncturists, and so they take a pulse. And that act of listening to the pulse, you know, in that there, that can actually be a very intimate way of making contact. There's a great family therapist, actually, on the psychology side, Virginia Satir, who wrote about this. She said, I believe the greatest gift I can conceive of having from anyone is to be seen, heard, understood, and touched by them. The greatest gift I can give is to see, hear, understand, and touch another person. When this is done, I feel contact has been made. So in that act of witnessing, you know, if a good practitioner is listening to the pulse, you know, the person who is the client can already pick that up, you know, can already begin to step into that place of connection. There's already intimacy and a presence. And these practitioners, they were actually often very eclectic. I focused on Tibetan healers because I was in Northern California, and so it was a relatively easy community to make contact with. But some of these folks who I interviewed were Westerners who had done intensive training. They had become Tibetan medical doctors, or they had become acupuncturists. One of the people I interviewed was Heidi Harding, who's a Tibetan Bun practitioner who is doing acupuncture in New York State. And so when she would listen to the pulse, it's giving her some information. For instance, if there's variations between the pulses, between the right and the left side of the pulses, or if there's a change in how fast or slow, there are indications that there's some kind of separation from the person's mind, or that the mind is not resting in the heart. And that can happen. The Chinese classics say that the spirit, the Shen, are like little birds. they can get startled very easily from a loud sound or something that happens in the environment. And that happens for people. And sometimes I'll use that very imagery, and you can feel then there is an opening. People feel their experience is being witnessed. They say, yes, that's what I feel like. I feel like part of me has left. So the first treatment will be to stabilize the pulses, to return the shen, the spirit, back to the heart, so that the spirit rests in the heart like a nest. If the mind and the spirit come back to the heart, then the body can heal itself. But that regularity, the mind, the consciousness, has to be stable, has to be resting in the heart. And that's the same in the meditation tradition as it is in the medicine. First and foremost, the mind has to be resting in the heart. You know, so there are very specific, tangible ways in which their clinical practices are helping to restore these connections. You know, and you could focus on any one of these traditions, you know, the Tibetan medicine or the Shud ritual, and you could do a dissertation on that. But I was really interested in making sure to bring this back in a way that it could inform our helping professions on the Western side. So I distilled it into a few basic different ritual categories. So first of all, the way they set their intentions for their work. For some people who were doing a medicine Buddha practice on the Tibetan side, you know, they made sure to set that intention, the work they would do would benefit beings. Mindfulness, so that the practitioner, before the client comes in, is really gathering themselves so that the self can be an accurate instrument. Creating space, so creating something in the treatment room that is a sacred space, and then also creating space between them and the client. Creating space has so many levels, actually. My dissertation committee had a field day with that. It's like, well, which level do you mean? I mean, all of them. And I was like, I like all of them. And the thing is that my interviewees, they liked all of them too. You know, I've interviewed Geshe Chapur, who's one of the teachers at a Bun Center in San Pablo. And he would say something real simple, like, you know, most important is making space, inner making space. You know, and he could go out in a discourse, you know, about the, you know, space being that quality of mind, you know, the sky-like quality of mind, and it's also simply making sure that we've created space with our breath, we've created sacred space where we are in our room and with our people. And then through that, a therapeutic attunement can happen. As I've said before, relationship heals. Most of these healers on some level were evoking sacred power. And that's one place where I saw that there's a lot of beauty, especially in that Vajrayana tradition, in the way that these sort of difficult or dark emotions can be transformed. You know, all of it is really good material, and so there are things within these rituals that evoke, you know, evoke the anger or the pain or whatever that difficulty is. You know, in some way, if you want to work with it, you need to sort of bring it up, you need to call it up. And then once it's called up, then you can be with it and see it. And having seen it, you can relate to it in a new way. You can transform it, poison into medicine. So through these different practices, as I mentioned, you know, there's a change in consciousness, changing in awareness. And then the client is empowered to see all their relationships as healing relationships, really. You know, they are reconnected. So all of this, you know, has a real tangible implications for our healing world. You know, if we recognize that creating this space is healing, then we might not be quite so focused on the pharmaceuticals. Like right now, it's a challenge in the world of psychology because when you look at evidence-based medicine, the folks who are able to pay for the research trials and et cetera that can be replicated are the pharmaceutical companies. And there's something called the file drawer effect. You know, if the pharmaceutical companies don't like the way that a certain study came out, they can get filed away and you never hear about that. And so for that reason, the insurance companies are more likely to reimburse, you know, a happy pill than someone who's actually going to go and make a relationship with their therapist, you know, and work through. It's right now, it's a kind of challenge. And yet, you know, if, when we look at this, what are the resources that our communities had? You know, what are the resources that are embedded in these indigenous ways? It takes these MIT professors, you know, Peter Sankey and Otto Schwarmer, who have the clout of being at MIT to say, actually, what makes a difference? You know, what is what's that transforming quality that our society is most in need of right now? It's really old school. You know, what we need is presence. And when you're able to come from that place of presence, it shifts from that dualistic, you know, us and them mind, you know, to a place where there's just us. So those are just some of my, those are some of my thoughts. It's always dangerous to get someone started talking about a dissertation because it's 200 pages after all, you know. But maybe that just creates some ground for good conversation. I like if people have questions. Yeah.
Well, I'm really trying to get to the essence of what you're saying.
Yeah.
I was really captured by the image of the mind and the spirit have to nest in the heart.
Yeah.
So if someone's all messed up and they come to the person who's got presence, and are you saying that... I don't know, sort of like a nonverbal level, being with someone who does have their mess.
Yes, that already begins to create a limbic resonance.
Okay, so it starts to create a resonance without any, and so a person can either instantly or gradually feel this happening in themselves.
Yeah, and then you know, the whatever the healer's primary modality is, you know, if they're doing acupuncture or they're doing herbs or they're doing therapy, you know, it's like there's a good ground for that to work.
Right, but it could also be a tarot card reader or a, I'm kind of puzzled by, I know you were focusing in on Buddhism.
Yeah.
But isn't this a healing modality that's universal?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that actually Peter Sankey and Otto Schwarmer note right in their book that this is something that, these are great questions, that this is something that's been found in indigenous societies and in Buddhist societies. And so from that perspective, it's not new. It just needs to be lifted up again.
The importance of having contact with someone that you're going to for help.
Yeah, who's going to help you to reconnect with that sacred world inside of yourself, because they haven't lost contact with the sacred world inside of themselves. And that, yes, you could do that in some way just through mindfulness-based stress reduction, but there are beautiful and deep ritual forms. Whether we look at that from a Buddhist perspective and you say, here are these really lovely pujas, you know, and the puja is helping you in some way to externalize the sacred and then again to find it within yourself.
But I like that you talk about it in terms of a healer.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Go off and, I mean, people even say that you can't just go off and heal yourself by yourself.
No, that was a huge piece. That relationship piece was what I found. was king. Yeah. Okay.
Well, did you find that these healers had the ones that are most effective? I mean, when you talk about Tibetan doctors, they're in a meditation practice or have been for many, many, many years.
Yeah.
So is there a part of a training that goes into creating a reliance on the presence?
Well, for them, as their medical training and their meditation practice have been woven together a long time. Right, so for them, that they have their own medicine Buddha practices, and they've been taught from the beginning that they have to go into this with that kind of vow, you know, the vow to help all beings. They need to keep up their meditation, and that mindfulness is going to help very tangibly, right, in being able to pick up the subtleties of the pulse, but it's also going to help very tangibly. There are specific things in the Tibetan medical texts that say, you know, the doctor has to have this perspective of compassion for the clients. You know, they have to be able to see their clients in that way. Otherwise, you know, they're in the wrong profession. So there is a training that they get, and that's something that we don't have a parallel for at all on the Western medical side.
Actually, there is. There's, I think, at Harvard now they have an institute of placebo medicine. Do you happen to know about that? It's fascinating. Mm-hmm. It turns out that sometimes placebos are more effective than the actual things, and that presence is often the difference between the effectiveness of even medication.
Yeah. Well, Herb Benson has been involved in some of the studies at Harvard. So, yeah, I mean, there are places where Western medicine is getting curious about this, but there's certainly there's not much required training for Western doctors about how would you do self as instrument.
Right. That's true.
Yeah.
One of the areas that I think this could really be exciting, besides the therapeutic, is the parental relationship with children. Because I've observed more and more with the technology we have, the contact between parents and children is less and less.
Yeah.
And there's a whole group of children that are growing up in stress, in pain, in all sorts of things. And to bring that connection of the parent and the child, it would allay a lot of the adult problems.
Oh yeah.
You know, down the line. So to start a conversation of how what you're talking about could be introduced.
Yeah.
Into that parent-child.
That's definitely a chapter in the dissertation.
Yeah.
You know, that's actually a piece that where my advisor wasn't sure we really needed it, but there's such good studies going on right now about the attachment theory, and of course, you know, Dan Siegel there, having done some mindfulness training now, sort of is this best advocate for it, you know, very engaging, and is able to talk about how all of our relationships are really modeled on that early one, because that's what we're wired in for. You know, the patterning for our relationships, the way that we connect to others, is mostly laid down during the first 2 years of life. The challenge for that is that, of course, we don't have conscious memory of that time. The amygdala is working, and the amygdala forms the tacit memories. Tacit memories are the kinds of feelings we get if we see someone and we have a response to them. Maybe they smell a little bit like our grandmother, you know, or we see a dog and we have aversion and we don't really know why. And maybe we had a bad encounter with a dog when we were very little.
Now, one of the first things that a baby does, how a baby reaches out to the world, is with the eyes.
Yeah.
And if that baby does not receive any eye contact back, that baby will literally start to withdraw from the world. So that simple contact, which we may take for granted, looking at a child, for many children, there isn't there. The mother now may now be on a cell phone, you know, nursing, but on a, you know, there's these just very basic, simple things that can be talked about and reestablished, that really go a long way to to creating wholeness in a child.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's huge. And, but, and because, right, that's happening on the tacit level, the body-centered level, that's one reason I feel that these embodied actions are the ones that have the greatest potential to heal that. Because you need to get to that place before words. You need to get to that place where just understanding something cognitively isn't it. So, yes. True.
I hope you pursue it.
So the training for someone who's trying to become a healer, and specifically for this modality of healing presence, how is that different from someone who's training just to be, say, a bodhisattva or an authentic human being or a guru or something like that? Is there something particular to the, you know, the somatic healing that...
I think that's a fine question. I was reflecting on that too. And that's, if I thought it was only presence, right, then I wouldn't have needed to have these different categories, you know, for the, you know, the, what I'm calling the categories of ritual. I mean, I'm sure that you can think of, and I can think of, like, people in the meditation communities who were teachers who had great samadhi but didn't have that quality of connection in their close relationships. And so that's where I sort of, I hold that, right? Just, I hold that as a great question. You know, how is it to have that presence and then also to make sure, right, that the mind and the heart are really entrained together so this is something that is a healing. It's creating the attachment, the connection that needs to happen for the patients. I've seen it, you know, I've discussed it with the folks who participated in my study. And so I guess that would be a possibility for further research, you know, doing a comparison, you know, taking a group of meditation teachers and taking a group of these, you could say, highly realized healers and looking across the board, you know, for those qualities of effective relationship. You know, are there the same, or are these two communities a little different? I think in most situations there would be that quality of attunement, and then in the situations where there wasn't that quality, I guess I would just lift that up and say, well, what's the variable then? Yeah, I haven't answered that. Yeah.
The sentence that describes the core of my practice is that a bigger idea of language and conversation makes a bigger reality. And healing needs a lot of space. We're very word-centered reality.
Yeah.
And word-centeredness limits our experience of language and of conversation. And conversation. Recently, have you heard of baby sign?
Yes, I have.
They're introducing sign language to babies well before speech.
Yeah.
And it seems that children can learn up to more than 100 hand signs before they're able to say their first word. So by the time we move into actual speech, into the speaking part of language, they're actually very conversational. And so hopefully they move it. They move into, when they move into speech, they already have an active, their conversation already has dimension.
Yes.
Dimension. And I think a big part of the problem is our idea of language is too word-centered and too, and that constricts our whatever.
Yeah, it constricts our understanding. Absolutely. Yeah. And so that's, I think that's where this, you know, Sankey and Schwarmer were going, which is even within, right, this sort of dualistic world of language and stuff, you know, one can be more connected, you know, to presence, you know, even within a place that's very cognitive, like higher education, you know, there are ways in which you can connect more with the ecosystem awareness of each other. You know, you can go back to some of these processes that are aligned with nature. Either, you know, from an indigenous perspective, we all have that same original instructions. You know, we all have, on some level, the capacity for this connection. And so, my hope is, right, that this kind of spurs people to think about that. You know, one of the papers that influenced my dissertation was something by Maureen O'Hara, and it was published by the APA, American Psychological Association. And what was interesting was that she had been studying with Carl Rogers. So Carl Rogers is a sort of great man of humanistic psychology. You know, if you're like a therapist in Sonoma County, you're probably a big fan of Carl Rogers. He's that kind of guy. It's hard not to like him. You know, but what was really interesting was that one year the Rogerians decided to go and have their conference in Brazil. And that sort of opened them up. It's like, wow, we need to take our ideas about empathy a whole other level. Like, you know, we need to drop in a quantum level more into the body and into this ecosystem awareness. Because in Brazil, just having some heady idea about empathy isn't it. It's like they've already got some way of knowing. And so that Maureen O'Hara and then also Joan Castiglione refer to that as a radical empathy. You know, empathy that isn't just understanding where another person is, but really sensing it.
I'm wondering if you could say a bit about your research methodology.
Yeah.
And the presence that you bring to it. I know Sophia in the past was looking at, like, feminine-based research and so on, and where that all is these days.
Well, I chose a narrative approach. That's the first thing. So this was... I chose the narrative approach because I felt that it would give the healers the most, it would give me the opportunity to create the research in a way that was the most true to the researchers' stories. You know, in some other forms of research, what you're doing is you're sort of taking out the bits and reconstructing according to the researcher's point of view. And I wanted to make sure that this came as close as possible to the healer's lived experience. So the narrative gave me as little of extra lens as possible. Then through that, another lens that I picked up was actually indigenous research. Well, indigenous research is something that has been a more recent movement within psychology and the other social studies. And what indigenous research says is we have to change the paradigms by which we do research because there's expectations, there's cultural values that are already embedded in the paradigm. And by choosing your research method, you're already implicitly accepting those assumptions. So in order to do this, you know, I spoke to Eduardo Duran, who is a Native American psychologist who's also a practitioner of Vipassana. And I said to him, you know, it's like I have a little feeling about this. You know, I'm doing narrative, but somehow I need to do it in a way that breaks out of the narrative box because it's not just the verbal story. And he said, yes. He was just authoring something in the indigenous research thing field called story science. And there's a few different exciting ideas he has about doing research. But one of the ones that I brought in was that you need to, in order to study a culture or to study a people, you need to use paradigms that are congruent. You need to bring in these extra layers of the cultural information. So for instance, if you're studying Buddhist healers, but you don't bring in the cultural information about what five element theory is, or you don't bring in the cultural information about what the levels of a symbol are in Tibetan Buddhism, then something is missing, because you can hear Chapur Rinpoche saying the most important is making space, inner making space. And if unless you bring in those extra layers, you don't know that he's referring to space on, you know, like the outer, inner, secret. It's like he has a whole worlds within worlds about making space. And in order to honor that, right, I included those layers. In a traditional narrative research, you wouldn't include the extra information, but by talking to Eduardo Duran, I did include it, and it made a difference. It gave me permission to go and to look at things in this embodied way and to bring extra information in. So that's where I was coming from. Definitely Sophia or Institute of Transpersonal Psychology has done some nice, really nice work in terms of looking at research methods that are more, that give you more space to look and to do an inquiry in an intuitive way, in an organic way, like literally intuitive inquiry, organic inquiry. And that means it gives the researcher permission in a way to circle back. That here's the first layer of the research, and then you sort of let go and on an inner process, and you can circle back to that and you revise. Now, yes, on some level you're always doing that, but it lifts it up and it makes it an official part of the process. You know, we're going to circle this at least three times. Rosemary Anderson, who was there, you know, did some really remarkable deep stuff with that. I chose narrative research especially because it is a research method that's known outside of the transpersonal psychology world. You can go to Harvard and they'll talk about narrative research and it has some credibility in the field. You know, for myself as a researcher, that's one thing I didn't want people to have to work too hard on. If they look and they see it's narrative research, at least they figure they recognize something. What's going on now at Institute of Transpersonal Psychology / Sophia University might be something completely different, because it did just go under a change of management. And we just sort of lift that up to the universe. Yeah.
So many things you said were like hitting me, but I went to this woman, she was a chiropractor, she's been working on me for about 10 years. So we kind of, you know, there's been so much growth that's happened over the years. But one thing I saw this time, which was really so healing to me, was that I hadn't been to her for a couple months. And I thought, oh God, when I go on, I have to tell her this and this and this. And I didn't have to. And that was such a thing that took away so much stress that she made me feel with her presence.
Yeah.
It was just a presence that she could dance with me. I mean, her energy was so in line with mine, I could just totally let that. I was like, freedom, oh my God. You know, and I could just say the word, but I feel like that's the most important thing for me, like everything that was said today, what you were saying about children, people with their cell phones, and I get so scared about petrified about the communication that's happening. What about all these young people? Are they being helped? Are they being guided? I mean, can their parents do this? Am I not having these children, but I'm one of 11, so I feel like I was a mom, you know, already. But this is like food to my soul, everything you're saying, so
thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. It's also kind of reassuring because some of this is what I'm going to share when I give this commencement speech next weekend at the California Institute for Human Science, which is my new employer. I'm giving, it's kind of really unusual, I think, to get your PhD in June and speak at the commencement in September. I'm hanging out with that odd karma. But however that is, right, I'm just sort of stepping in. And so some of the ideas, right, that have been occurring to me, they gave me a topic, which is institutions, the evolution of institutions. It's like, oh, that's so theoretical. Whoever in their commencement wants to listen to that. But what I've been thinking about is how our institutions are also living systems. How our institutions also are made up of individuals who can cultivate presence, and then through that, right, the institution can evolve in a good way. Every institution, everything anyway, is always changing, but how things change is really up to us. And so what we're doing in the way that we're being, that's it's not what someone said necessarily, but it's really how they were able to be. So that's what I'm sort of holding up as an opportunity, for our institutions. It's like when they're able to come back to this place of honoring the people, in their wholeness, then the institution is also able to step into its wholeness. The institution and the people, need to be in a kind of correspondence. Not only what the institution needs from the people who are involved, but what those people need from the institution. And so when that happens, I think we have the potentiality, right, to make the shifts that we need to. My teacher, Mahako Sananda, would say, a peaceful heart makes a peaceful person. A peaceful person makes a peaceful family. A peaceful family makes a peaceful community. A peaceful community makes a peaceful nation. And a peaceful nation makes a peaceful world. So sometimes I just reflect on that and say, well, what can I do from this little corner of the world where I am?
What was the word that you started
then
with? Peaceful what makes a peaceful person?
A peaceful heart.
Okay.
Yeah. It's so simple. But, attaining that could take a lifetime. So is there anything else that's springing to mind? Anything you want to ask about my life, my practice, the whole world situation?
Do you have to be a healing presence with all these students?
Oh, yeah. That was definitely what I felt that I could contribute. That there was one place on campus that wasn't sort of like measuring and assessing, and where they weren't measuring and assessing and trying to be perfect, but we were just able to be with what is. And that was changing students' outcomes. I mean, very tangibly. Some of the students there have had anxiety because they were so caught up in that perfectionism. It might take them an hour to compose an email. And so we worked that down. So then it was only like taking 10 minutes or something. And now I see them and they're all grown up. So something must have happened. So yeah, I am here locally now. I'm sort of relocated to the East Bay, and I do work with people. I do energy work myself, hence my interest, and also do some ceremonies and some retreats with people, spiritual counseling. If you're curious, if you want to stay connected, there's some people who have attended the talks before. We had nice correspondence. So if this sparks something and you want to keep it up, then just look for me. I think my email is probably on the Many Rivers website or something. I think there's some contact somewhere. But anyway, thanks so much, everyone, for coming.
And thank you so much for coming on behalf of Many Rivers. Thank you. Yeah. That's wonderful. Okay. And so, of course, I need to remind you that we have a donation bowl over on the counter. We encourage you to contribute to that to help support our speaker as well as this space for further such events, because we've put the money. There's a copy of Jihong's first book there, but I know that there's going to be another book coming. Discussing. Oh, I feel pretty secure in saying that. Maybe in a year or two, perhaps. And so we'll let you know about that when that happens. And thank you so much for coming to Many Rivers tonight. Mm-hmm. Don't forget about our cool events coming up the rest of the month.
Sally?
My name is Linda Anderson.
Linda, oh, that's it. Yes.
Yes.
That's right. I remember absolutely. You studied with Lama Sutramelioni. Or you practiced with her?
I have. I a long time ago.
Okay.
And I don't travel a lot, so I don't study with her. And I studied with her in country these days for years.
Sure.
Yeah. Nice to meet you.
Thank you. Likewise.
Absolutely. So you're doing in these days?
Well, I practiced then, but I've also gone and attended some other ceremonies. Some of this I got connected with through the research, like the Tibetan Bun community locally. I'll go to Center for the Sacred Stream. I go to their events in Berkeley. And then I also do some of these new moon and full moon ceremonies that come out of the Peruvian tradition, but actually bear some kind of interesting similarities to the soak and to the soak rituals. That's something that I offer to people.
Well, I hope I can get down to the East Bay. It's not so easy for me to get down there with you.
Well, I hope we continue to connect so auspiciously. I really appreciate meeting you finally in person.
I know. And you know what? I'm glad I've got a master's from ITP.
Oh, wow.
1990.
Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. I got in just in time.
When did you just finish? When did you start?
I started in, I think, 2011.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. So
you just made it.
Yeah. I was working on my dissertation and everything was going through.
Yeah, I was watching all that on the web.
There's still some good people involved, but I think a lot of it is hard as well in its exodus. Rosemary Anderson Bessett, she's founded something online called ITPA. It's sort of like Institute of Transpersonal Psychology Association. It's like a professional association for people who want to stay connected and share ideas.
Yeah. And Bob Frager?
He's still there physically, but I just think he's got marginalized a bit, sadly, because I think he's a great presence. I wish I'd had a chance to experience. Wow.
Anyway, I
hope to see you again. I trust. We will see each other. Thank you.
I have a card.
Let's see. It's always a little bit of a toss-up.
Ask you a quick thing about.
Could you talk about the first 2 years of life?
Well, here we go.
Yeah.
My sister was in the hospital for 2 months. She was either 6 months old or maybe 1 year old.
Yeah.
And all her life she's been and just in the last few years, I think it's definitely a period in her first 2 years where she was, she got the salmonella infection, and 3 months in the hospital,
That's a long time. That definitely affects them. It's not that there can't be shifts, you know, there's what they call neuroplasticity, so we form new connections, and even one really trustworthy relationship can make a difference in terms of how she connects. It could be a therapeutic relationship that helps her to heal that. You know, and yes, I mean, maybe she's also just geared for a little bit different connection.
I'm feeling good. But I'm hoping that at some point, you know, but that's my idea of what a life should be. She's a little further.
Yeah, so is she here locally?
She's in Portland.
Oh, that's funny. I know. Here's actually a card for a healer who's out in Petaluma.
Oh,
he's very good. His website's on the back. Stephen Encino. He works in terms of what I'm saying, you know, someone who has presence, someone who works somatically and energetically and intuitively as well as through making connections. He can go pretty deep in terms of what he does. I mean, I would give him my strongest recommendation.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, just saying. You can have my card too, but she should go with him.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, like, she's not too big for a puppy yet.
Yeah.
Like, I have a I'm not able to use my hands at all, right? That's the way it's working. I'm working to heal it.